Welcome to Pocket Change. Pocket Change is an offshoot of the Helios Consulting podcast. During Pocket Change, we interview and discuss different issues and topics that surround change leadership and help sustain and support long-term anchored change. Welcome back to Pocket Change, our quick-paced offshoot of the Helios Consulting podcast. And today I'm really excited to have my partner, Michael Gill, join us today to talk about empathy. As listeners would know, empathy is probably what I would believe to be the foundational pillar of our resiliency when it comes to being able to relate to other people, create connection and belonging. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited about this topic as well. As you know, I'm very passionate about empathy.
You are. And so why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are, the practices that you work within inside of Helios, some of your interests, and maybe just a bit about you and your background.
Sure. So my name is Michael Gill, and I have been consulting for, 22 years now. It's hard to believe it's been that long. But I love consulting because I love working with people. And I was kind of, a couple years ago, 3 years ago, I was really not interested in consulting anymore. And I think what happened to me is I was stung by the deliver out of the box bee. And it was, you had to conform and do things a certain way. And I just didn't like that anymore because I like to be creative in my consulting. I like to work with people, as you know, Kate. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're kind of drawn together, is we kind of have very similar approaches when it comes to people and putting them kind of first in any situation that we deal with, as best we can anyways. But I'm currently with Helios, a partner with Helios, and I joined because of the great people that I get to work with. And my practice is in the areas of asset management, risk and reliability, which, you know, is a mouthful, and for some would understand what it is and others wouldn't have a clue what it is. But it's really, you know, just managing equipment and managing risks that you take on day to day in business, and doing it scientifically and not just kind of off the cuff, if you will. In the interim, when I was kind of going through my what could I call it? I could call it my second midlife crisis, if you will, trying to figure out what it is I wanted to do. I was kind of passionate about psychology when I was first in university, and I went back and did my master's in psychology, all online. And believe me, when you're in your late 40s, knocking on 50, well, I am 50 now, but back then you're very hesitant in doing something like that. But the reason I wanted to is because I always like working with people. So that's one element that consulting always brought. But I also am very passionate about helping people, and the psychology, I thought, what a better place to be. And not only that, I'm not one to retire. I can see myself being busy and doing things. So I wanted to put myself in a place where I could be in my 70s and still, you know, counsel people if I had to. Now, I still have to get my license, of course. That's a little tricky step with all this COVID stuff going on right now, but it is something that's in the plans for sure. Mm-hmm. And that's basically it. And obviously, because of the psychology piece, when I heard what you do, Kate, before I joined Helios and got an understanding of what it is you did, I was just like, wow, where has this been my whole career? You know, for 20 years, this whole people element was never there. I mean, there was attempts. We brought it in kind of late in the game, but it was very cookie cutter delivery and not well thought out, I'll say, from a standpoint of empathy, considering people's needs and understanding what they're going through. And I think this conversation is going to be very valid today.
Absolutely. And it just, you know, that is one of the things that we do very different, is the human interaction is really the core of who we are at Helios. You know, recognizing that nothing that we do would matter if people weren't a part of it. I mean, when we think about asset reliability and integrity, and we think about risk management, we do those things so that we don't blow equipment up and hurt people and kill people and damage communities and have those really horrific ripple effects. And so I think there's an element of that. And, you know, one thing that's really fantastic is in our organization, you are the champion and kind of the leader who we look to around our summer of support in terms of engaging our communities and working with the Calgary Food Bank and FASE up in the Yukon and working with Twyla on those things. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact is that you care about people. And so when you think about empathy, what are some of the things when you look back in the rearview mirror that really helped shape you in that nurture versus nature? Because I think that's a conversation that people have quite often. Are we born empathetic or do we learn empathy? What are your thoughts on that?
That's a really good question. And I've kind of got two answers to that. Some of it is scientific. So the science says we are born with empathy. It's just that a lot of people just don't know how to or have the appropriate responses to it. They don't know how to deal with it. It's been said that we can actually inherit empathy through our genes, and we can do one of two things: we can repel it, or we can embrace it. And I think that's what we see with people. And I like to think that, to some degree, we all have empathy. We all have it. We just don't know how to respond to it or deal with it. I think of when I think of empathy, it can be somewhat a burden to some people if they don't know how to deal with it appropriately. And I know this because my own father was not the most empathetic person. He was a very stern kind of militant person. So, but I saw tons of empathy pouring from my mother. My mother's like the most empathetic person ever. So I'd like to think that at some point in my life, I had a little bit of both, where I was kind of felt burdened by it. And I was like, I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to have to step into someone else's reality and try and figure out how to make them feel better. Whereas as I got older, a side of me was found it very intriguing. And I also saw that I was able to get results from it. Results meaning that I was able to influence some kind of positive change in somebody's life, whether that be through work, Kate, or in a personal conversation, personal situation. So, you know, it does take practice. It's not something that I think everybody has, because I think it requires a great deal of patience, because you are actively attempting to understand another person's perspective and their emotions to some degree, and even deeper, trying to understand their behaviors, right, under certain perspectives. And in some cases, the behavior is what we see first, and we're thinking that was absolutely ridiculous. Why is this person responding this way? Because that's what we see on the outside, right? So that's one of the things that I guess the nerd in me really wanted to uncover and try and figure out why is somebody behaving that way? Why would somebody do that? What is it? What is happening? And empathy is a big part of that, is just trying to figure out what has this person gone through in their life? What traumatic events occurred? And what's happened within the last 24 hours or even 15 minutes that's influencing this type of behavior or encouraging this type of behavior, right? Mm-hmm. And then dealing with the behavior, that's the other side of the coin, obviously. That's another whole conversation.
Absolutely, it is. And, you know, I look at this and I think I've mentioned it on Pocket Change before, but when we think of resiliency, we often talk about resiliency being a like a concrete slab. We're born and they put our little body on a concrete slab, and everything from birth really shapes our resiliency skills. And so when we think about the facets of empathy, right, like you've laid down an example, and I think your father was in law enforcement and my father was also in an element of law enforcement. However, he was further down the line after people had been apprehended, convicted, so on and so forth. And my father was very much the same way, where he had, I don't say that he was anything but empathetic, but he was situationally stronger in terms of how he would approach putting himself in somebody else's shoes. So, for example, if he had somebody on his caseload who had fetal alcohol syndrome, which was very common in the Yukon, he would have a very different empathetic approach in terms of how he worked with that individual. I mean, they have an organic brain injury. They have holes in their brain, yeah, basically. Then you have somebody who has been habitually, quote, I'm doing air quotes, bad. But again, it's what was the damage to their foundation as a child? And as we know from even some of our other podcasts that we've done, there are so many different ripple effects in the world that prevent people from being able to truly embrace and grow within an empathetic state. So when you think of encouraging or growing empathy, like I think of a time when I was working in an oil and gas, it was in a startup, and one of the engineering managers, he came to me and he said to me, I don't have empathy. And I said, okay. And he said, so he goes, you think you can teach me how to be empathetic? And I said, I do. I think I can help you be empathetic as a leader. And what you do in these four walls, that's what I'm concerned about. What you do outside of these four walls really has nothing to do with me. It's none of my business.
Yeah.
When you think of, you know, going back to that foundation and think of influencing people and helping them grow or peel back the layers of understanding, what does it look like for somebody to work on and enhance their empathy? Because if we're not born with it and we don't just naturally know how to do it, what are some ideas that you would recommend somebody take into consideration to become more empathetic, to even think to ask the question, why would a reasonable, mm-hmm, rational human being behave like this? Like, mm-hmm, what gets you to the point where you want to be empathetic, or say you want to be, but you don't know how?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the funny thing about empathy is we all expect it at some point in time.
Yeah.
We all expect somebody to understand. We've said it violently and non-violently sometimes. Why don't you understand what I'm going through? Right? And that's usually the method I use if somebody, you know, approaches me and says, well, I'm not empathetic at all. And then I, you know, I don't want to debate with them, but I have the conversation that, well, there have had to have been times in your life where you've wanted somebody to understand the current situation that you are in. And that's basically all it is it's you placing that expectation in this case of somebody understanding what you're going through. Well, that's the exercise of empathy on you doing that to somebody else. And sometimes when you apply the empathy, and it could be cognitive empathy or it could be affective empathy. Cognitive empathy is more along the lines of just kind of understanding people's emotions, kind of the basics. But affective empathy is really the part when you can almost, it's a mirroring effect. It's when somebody's explaining a story to you or explaining something to you, and you almost can feel exactly what it was, and you create that mirror effect between you and the person that you're speaking to. And that's kind of the piece that we need to uncover with people and say, you have empathy, you just don't know you have empathy, or you're being resistant to empathy because you have an ulterior motive or an ulterior agenda in what you're trying to get through. And empathy is not a bad thing. Empathy is a very good thing. It's I don't know why people shy away from it. That's another podcast in its own, Kate, is why would people want to be resistant to empathy when most of us as humans kind of want it and need it in return when we go through our struggles and our situations? So that's typically the conversations I have with people. And I've known a few people that have said they're not empathetic, and you know, some of them, when they're close friends, I can say, well, you're lying to me. And others, I try to break the conversation down a little bit more and explain why it's not true that they don't.
Yeah. And it's interesting because we have, of course, our Resilient Leader Program, and you've seen it in action. You've helped co-facilitate, mm-hmm, that with me a time or two. And one of the things that we actually do is, well, we being me, is I have a ukulele. And when we start to talk, mm-hmm, empathy, I pull my ukulele out and
love
if
it.
You wanna,
love
if you want to, if you want to see an engineer turn inside out and into stardust and try and get away, play a ukulele and play Kumbaya, because, man, I'll tell you what, it freaks them out. And, you know, it's interesting because That, I think that's the other thing, is that people equate empathy with weakness. And what we teach people through and we facilitate people through on The Resilient Leader is really talking about empathy as a tool of helping drive change and helping understand people and helping anticipate the needs of people during change. And I think that when we lay this on top of the change curve, if we're going out and we're doing an impact assessment and we're looking at an organization and we're saying, okay, if we're going to do these major process changes, for example, I use process because it's the very safe change. And, you know, we're going to do these process changes. What's the difference to somebody's job? Are we creating swivel chair? Are we, you know, asking them to do something that's outside of their realm of capability and understanding and comprehension, which then leads into tactics to be empathetic towards those people while they're going through that change. And what we've done in the past is, and we do it actually in our Resilient Leader program, in our Visible Safety Leadership program, is we ask people to tell us what their greatest fear is at work. And it's astounding how many people have very similar fears. And so that's how we embed empathy. So we did a Resilient Leader workshop a couple of weeks ago with a large group of people, field staff, field leaders. And that was what we did. We said, okay, well, here, call, text Kate, and here's a number, put it up on the screen. And we invited them to let us know what their greatest fears were. And the greatest fears that we find are failure, the fear of failure, the fear of incident and injury and illness, environmental damage, things like that. Depends on industry, right? It also depends on where someone sits in an organization. But what we find is that the higher up we get in an organization, the greater the fear of failure. And in addition to that, what we do is we take that and we say, okay, now listen and reflect. And I read all of these random text messages that come into my phone, and I have screens and screens of them. And you go in and what it does is it enables people to have to feel empathy in that moment, particularly if you and I texted the same thing. I hear the word failure, I automatically think that that's my text. You hear the word failure come in a second or a third time. Now I'm like, oh, so there's five or six of us in here who feel that failure is one of the biggest things that we're scared of at work. That's there's power to that, right? In creating common understanding. And so absolutely. Then it comes down to how do we move towards a collective goal, whether that collective goal is to pull towards the 3-year strategy, whether that's to keep people safe on the job, to be more reliable in how we manage our assets or how we manage our risk. And so finding common ground, I think, is also a really strong place for us to start to build empathy, because it is, it's you plus me equals the we. And when we can come together, it creates really beautiful harmony in terms of allowing people to feel part of something bigger, right? Connection and belonging, I think, is one of the things. The other thing, and I'm very interested on your take on this, is when we think about using empathy to be able to read a room, to be able to see power dynamics that are at play and be able to use those to our advantage. I think, you know, maybe I'm giving away trade secrets here, but, you know, because you and I think are both very empathetic people, but I think, you know, and I was very over empathetic when I first started my career. And you take some knocks and you get punched in the face a couple of times, figuratively, not literally. And you really start to learn that you sometimes have to question people in their motives around empathy. So when you think about that and you think about coming in, reading a room and being able to look at body language and being able to kind of see those power dynamics, what does that look like for you? How do you diagnose a room when you walk into a group of operators and you need to build a reliability program and you know that 30% of them are not going to want to engage with you because of their reduced capacity of empathy?
Yeah. No, that's another great question. And first of all, I don't think you can ever be too empathetic, Kate. I think being empathetic is very important, but I don't think you could ever be too empathetic. I think in how you respond is maybe what it was overindulgent, maybe, right?
Perhaps.
But the empathy, the more you can mirror somebody's situation, the better empathy is, right? And that's what I talked about, you know, earlier. But yeah, I think you pretty much answered your own question here. When you walk into a room and you see all these operators and maintenance guys and stores personnel or whoever's looking back at you, and you're trying to kind of get everybody somewhere. And I think the term you used was common ground. And I think that's really the best position, I guess, is what you're trying to get to when you have all these people staring back at you. Because guaranteed, a little drop of empathy added into that room makes, and this is what I'm bringing back from my consulting career, is that I've sat in rooms where there's literally been two people that don't like each other sitting across the table, but we have to come to a common ground. So that's our objective, is coming to the common ground. It's how do we get to that common ground? And the tool of empathy, and this is before the psychology, Kate, this is me just trying to figure out how to get this guy to understand this guy. And what I would usually do is run them through an exercise where I would, you know, take a very general process and I would box and wire their process very, you know, simple on one side. Then I'd go to the other side of the table and I'd box and wire that person's process. And then I would say, let's talk to each one of these boxes and find out why you need to do these steps. And a lot of the times what that did is it let the person that was sitting across the other person see what that person, it was a day in the life, basically, seeing what that person goes through each day through those processes. And it allowed us to have broader conversations around, well, that process needs review and revision, right? But what it did is it exposed the truth of what that person was going through on a day-to-day basis. And skewed processes could be doing that, and the other person has no idea, right? And that's why my life is so miserable, is because this guy is doing things this way. Why is he not doing things this way? It's because we never bridge the conversation as to how we can make it better. And the other thing we do at Helios is we're always talking about sustainability and the ability to make sure whatever it is we build has a life cycle to it, that we can improve on it and we can fix it. And a lot of that's through communication. That's why we won't even push anything forward anymore until we build that communication bridge again. We want operators talking to the maintenance guys, right?
Yeah.
We want that active communication. So we build that. So that's a struggle that I've dealt with from the beginning of my career. And when I was, you know, a lot more immature, which is not much different than now, but that's another story. But, you know, I wasn't sure how to deal with it at all. I was actually kind of overwhelmed at dealing with conflict. But when you can really lay out kind of that empathetic template, if you will, by drawing out day in the life of each person and them seeing that, what that does is it opens it up and they start to understand, oh, that's why you do it that way. Oh, okay. I never knew there was a benefit to doing that. Or why are you doing it that way? It could be so much easier, right? It opens up doors and it gets rid of, flushes out some of the stuff that's not needed. But also just that small little exercise of, you know, exposing the day in the life builds a relationship as well, because now they've actively had a conversation about what they do. Now they understand each other a little bit better. So I've seen like worst enemies almost become kind of good friends by the time we were finished and left, because they were able to have a conversation.
We found that actually as well. We were on a major ERP triage project. And one of the things we had five social networks running at one time. And those social networks, some of them were hierarchical and some of them were not. And what I found was that when we had blended social networks, one of our process workshop or one of our process change networks, it was incredibly powerful because it was allowing one group of people who were like recipients of the demand in the downstream in the warehouse. It was allowing an individual contributor at the warehouse level the ability to interact and interface directly with leadership in demand management that was saying, you guys said you were going to do X, Y, and Z for us. This process is still broken, and therefore we can't deliver A, B, and C to the customer. And that was really, really powerful. And it's not just because people were heard, but it was because people were heard with empathy because they had a leader who didn't have that level of insight into what was going on in their day-to-day. And so I think that's a really powerful piece. And again, I think it's an example of how empathy is underutilized and underappreciated appreciated inside of business, particularly when it comes to transformation or change in driving for creating efficiencies, right? So I really like that example, and it really brought a whole bunch of profound thoughts, because when we think about our strategies and how we choose to manage change through the Helios models and how we go through and how we build our Manuka strategies to create stickiness of our change strategies and all of these different things, it does ring very significantly of creating empathy for the downstream to reduce those impacts to stakeholders who are going to be experiencing the change. So that's a really great insight. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And well, thanks, Kate. The other thing empathy is best, demonstrated when we are active listeners. You're an awesome active listener. I don't think I've met anybody that's better than you at that. And that's really, slowing down our responses and listening to what's really happening. And I think as consultants, when we go to site, and I've seen this happen actually, we kind of lead by example. Mm-hmm. And people kind of see us and how we're communicating with them and with each other. And they kind of desire that and want that. Right. Yeah. And that's one of the most important pieces to empathy, is that if you want to be empathetic people, you have to be an active listener. It can't be about you at that moment in time. It has to be, I really need to get in and understand exactly how this person is feeling. Right.
Absolutely. And that's, I appreciate that. And thank you. I think active listening is something that you have to learn. You have to think about. You have to be very intentional with that. And I think it is a very key piece to empathy. And one of the other things that we often give people in terms of tips is tuning in. Are things like social media and Facebook and TikTok and, Teams is a really, really, really great detractor from being able to be present with people and truly just listen and be with them. And I think that where some of the tips that we give people is just tuning in, as I refer to the phone, the old talk box, put it down, right? I often use the example of my daughter. So my daughter is going to be coming up on 17 here in December. And for the past several years, once you come through the come up and you're done working your 90 hours a week, as we all do in consulting, mm-hmm. putting the phone down, when she walks into the room, it doesn't matter who I'm talking to, who I'm texting, what email I'm reading, what client is on the line. My kid walks in the room, I put that phone down, right? Mm-hmm. She deserves my full attention. That's right. And, nobody, if I say that nobody is more important than her, then nobody can be more important than her. So tuning in and really paying attention and not allowing the distractions, I think, is a very key piece to that. Creating the opportunity for people to have vulnerability and be heard without retribution, kind of coming back repercussions, I think is a really important piece as well. And I think the ability to sit and listen. And, we just did a workshop this morning and we were talking about filler language. Mm-hmm, yep. Mm-hmm, yep. And, our managing partner, Mike, one of his favorite videos to show is Handsome Dan. So for listeners, if you want to hear an example or see an example of what not to do, Google Handsome Dan from, that was Wayne's World, I think, Wayne's World 2. But it's, how do you be present and how do you take everything else and silence the world so that you can truly be present with somebody and listen when they speak, and not listening to respond is the key. I don't need to be formulating my answer while we're talking. I want to hear what you have to say. And I think that is a very, very, very key and foundational piece to empathy. I think that's another really great tip and a great point that you bring up.
Well, it also, when we're active listeners, we develop better and deeper questions, right? Mm-hmm. We ask better questions, and it leads to us having a better understanding of what that person's worldview might be, right? And understanding it a bit more. It is absolutely key. You cannot have empathy and just be silent all the time. You have to be able to somewhat respond and not be afraid to ask questions, but well sought after questions. As a result of listening, you may even find that some of the situations that people have gone through or are going through are similar to what you are going through or have gone through in a certain time. So I'm also a big believer in using, you know, self-disclosure when it's appropriate, because you never want to make it about you, but use self-disclosure to maybe and entice that person or make that person feel a little bit more comfortable in what they're talking about.
Yeah, creating that vulnerability, that space to be heard and be safe. Yeah, we do a lot of that. Like, we do a lot of storytelling when we facilitate, right? Like, you've got reams and reams of stories. We all do. I mean, we have history in what we do. And I also think that it's also not feeling shame, right? When we think of shame, and I think it's Brené Brown, she's got so much on shame. And I would encourage anybody to go and just pull up some of her TED Talks and YouTubes on her, because it's phenomenal. And empathy is one of those places that is, as she describes it, one of the most hostile places for shame to live. Because if we're truly empathetic, we're truly present with people, and we're not there in a judgmental manner, then what it does is it kills shame really, really, really fast. Because it's not about looking back and saying, why did you do that? It's, okay, well, can you tell me more about that? What was the reasoning behind it? It almost leads us down more of a coaching conversation. And I think anybody who has a kid who has gone through any level of adolescence, we've all been there, right? Children don't always do the best things. I can remember my daughter, she was 14 at the time, and I had put a tracking device on her phone. Like, I had location services on. I think you and I've talked about this one. Mm-hmm. And one day I'm sitting there and the location services go off, and I'm like, that's fishy. So I send her a text message. Hey, how's it going? I was trying to show somebody a picture in the eye and I accidentally turned my location services off. Sure. So now my spidey senses are going off. And so I thought to myself, okay, self, I says, we're going to keep an eye on this one. So a little while goes back and my gut's kind of going off. And so I opened up her location. And so I see she's by this pizza place. And I'm like, why the heck is she on that side of town? And so I kind of zoom out to see where she actually is. She's in another town. And I've not heard of her leaving our town. And so I sent her a text message and I said to her, one, who's driving? Two, get in that car, buckle your seatbelt, drive the speed limit, and get your butt home. And, you know, I was livid. I was furious. And why was I furious? So I'm sitting there and I'm exploring for these answers. Why am I mad? Am I mad because I'm being defied? Am I mad because I'm being lied to? Am I mad because this is a high-risk situation of her driving in early March on a highway with a driver that I don't know? Yeah, probably all of those things, right? And so by the time she got through the door, I was quite a bit calmer. And she sat down, and the night before we'd had a conversation, and she said, you know, Mom, I just feel like you're strangling me. You're just choking me. And I said, well, you're hanging out with people I don't really know. And so that makes me uncomfortable, because you need to understand from my perspective that if I don't know these people, how can I possibly trust them with you when I don't even know their last names or I don't know who they are? You're the only little human I've ever made, and I sure love you a whole lot. Can you see that? And she says, yeah. And I said, okay, well, then I'll give you more rope if you're more transparent with me. And so she walks in the door and she sits down across from me and she's sheepish that I'll get out, because she's a good kid. And I said to her, I said, so? I said, what happened? She said, well, you gave me a whole bunch of extra rope and I hung myself on the first night. You know, but she was able to put herself in my shoes and really understand why I was feeling as anxious and upset as I was. And in the end, helped me pick her punishment. She was the one who selected the punishment and, you know, all that. Right. But so, you know, I'd like to think that we're doing a pretty good job on the whole empathy front. But it's just like I could have gone up and down one side of her and down the other and created a situation that didn't need to be what it didn't need to be by shaming her and making her feel bad and guilt tripping her and doing all the things that parents in the 70s and 80s would have done, right? Because I don't know about you, but I was raised on a really, really strong, significant diet of guilt, right?
Yeah.
Guilt, not necessarily shame, but guilt for sure, right?
I had no rope. It was a stick.
And I'm going to hit you with this.
That's right. And you know what, Kate, you know you're somewhat successful in parenting when your child has developed a conscience, right? I think that is a key component. And you know, with my kids, that's what I want to make sure at some, when they turn a certain age, and I don't know what age, and it's different for some of them, but when they start having a conscience and they start feeling bad for something that they've done, and you've created that openness where they can still come and talk to you about it or be honest about it, even when they do try and deviate a little bit. They all go to the same school of stories. So I can tell you, I've gone through very similar situations that you have with your daughter as well. So
That's funny. So yeah. This has been a really fantastic conversation, Michael. I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, I would like to invite any final thoughts, or if you think that there's any particular reading or materials that you would suggest that somebody could look at, whether it's personal development or professional development or organizational, anything that's really ever stuck out to you, or anything that you read, like say a blog or anything like that, that you'd recommend to people?
You know, I don't particularly follow any blogs as of yet. I am linked up with some psychology groups in Twitter, and they often will post, and you can type in any of them. They're all pretty good. But what they'll do is they'll give you a tip of the week or a tip of the day, which in some cases you'll see one that pops up with empathy, and they'll kind of explain how to practice it. I mean, a lot of the tools that we utilize in psychology now are through mindfulness, right? Becoming mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And my recommendation to anybody out there is just try testing mindfulness. Mindfulness in the sense of whether it's you eating a chip with your eyes closed and just tasting all the different sensations of a chip, or whether it is practicing empathy towards somebody else. Take a situation that you might despise because you're purely observing the behavior behind it, and try and figure out why that person might be experiencing that, right? And come up with scenarios that you might have or that you might exhibit from a behavior standpoint, and trying to link them up a bit. And remember this, that having empathy doesn't necessarily mean we want to help somebody in need, okay? Though it is often a vital first step towards compassionate action, okay? So even if we start just taking steps in understanding what empathy is, doesn't mean let's go help the world. It will come in handy for you one day, I promise you.
Oh, that is fantastic. Fantastic tips. Michael, thank you once again for joining us. And to our listeners, thank you for taking the time to tune in and listen to Pocket Change. If there's any topics that you'd ever like to hear from us, please go ahead and drop it in the comments. And remember, a phone call doesn't cost a thing.